Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. On the bicentenary of Frederick Douglass's birth, we commemorate the many sides of the man, the abolitionist, statesman, autobiographer, orator, reformer, essayist, politician, and not least of all, father. In this lecture, held on February 25, 2018, at the National Gallery of Art, Céleste Marie Bernier traces the activism, artistry, and authorship of Douglass alongside the sufferings and struggles for survival of his daughters and sons, Rosetta, Louis Henry, Frederick Jr., Charles Raymond, and Annie Douglass. As activists, educators, campaigners, civil rights protesters, newspaper editors, orators, essayists, and historians in their own right, his children each played a vital role in the freedom struggles of their father.
Suffering and struggle, pain and beauty are at the heart and life of Frederick Douglass and his family. In the 20 years of my life, looking, researching, working, and finding, and trying to understand those marks, traces, possibles, and probabilities of the many lives of Frederick Douglass, let alone the many lives of Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey, I am now working on the many lives of Rosetta Douglass, Louis Henry Douglass, Charles Raymond Douglass, Frederick Douglass Jr., and Annie Douglass. In a Black Lives Matter era, as today, white supremacy bleeds through every part of every brick of every building in every nation, the fight is by no means over. In a letter that I just read that Douglass writes a month before he dies, he says, "I see nothing has changed. We may not be bought and sold for market like brutes in the field, but we have nothing to live for in the current climate. Nothing to live for." At the age of 22, Douglass spoke repeatedly of feeling suicidal. As we think of and as we respectfully work with Mr. Douglass's life and his works, and with the lives and works of his family, we have a burden of responsibility, one that is social, political, moral, intellectual, and philosophical. We have a burden of interpretation, we have a burden of representation, and we have a burden of working against the white racist archive that denies, distorts, and obliterates. In the 20 years that I've worked on Frederick Douglass, I've worked to find a figure lost in history. In a Black Lives Matter era, as we face and continue to face contemporary lynchings, lynchings by any name only, we continue that fight and we continue to remember Douglass's words. "Nothing has changed for the black man," he writes, "nothing to hope for." Rosetta Douglass famously writes her father, "I feel I am in bondage." Louis Henry Douglass writes of struggles for liberty as a combat veteran, remembering standing by Robert Gould Shaw as he dies in front of him. Louis Henry Douglass, who lived with wounds of war, as Douglass lived with the scars of slavery. The no man's land that Horace Pippin described as the ghost-like memory of slavery as they lynch our bodies while we fight for freedom in the Argonne. A freedom that is in name only. Frederick Jr. repeatedly wrote, a man who died too young, who died while Frederick Douglass was alive, he spoke that, "I do not understand the white race. I do not understand their privilege and their power. I reject their supremacy." In the life and works of Douglass, and in the life and works of Douglass's family, the burden of representation is understanding the failures of Western academia. Western academia are history, genealogical records that deny and distort, that look for names, dates, and facts. In the 20 years that I've worked in the field, working with materials, working with archives, working in the case of the 15th Regiment in World War I, whose records have been entirely burned, as Robert Marshall, one of the most important African-American lawyers, described it, "We're taken out into the field and lynched, and no one knows we lived." The question remains how to deal with this terrain. How to understand, interpret, and respectfully engage with an archive that is missing, lost, and denied. Suffering, struggle, and survival. Heretofore, colored Americans have thought little of adorning their parlors with pictures. They have had to deal with the stern, and I may say, the ugly realities of life. Pictures come not with slavery and oppression and destitution, but with liberty, fair play, leisure, and refinement. These conditions are now possible to colored American citizens, and I think the walls of their houses will soon begin to bear evidence of their altered relations to the people around them. This portrait represents truly, as it does, the face and the form of our first colored US Senator, Hiram Reynolds, and it is a historical picture. It marks with almost startling emphasis the point dividing our new from our old condition. Every colored householder in the land should have one of these portraits in his parlor and should explain to his children, as the dividing line between the darkness and despair that hangs over our lives, the light and hope that is now coming. For Frederick Douglass, art was the way out of despair and destitution. He instructed Helen Pitts that at his death, his profession should not be listed as statesman, but should be listed in exactly and precisely these words: literary, author, editor, and publisher. Frederick Douglass understood the importance of art as a beacon of hope, and he saw art and activism as conjoined in the struggle. He persistently understood art as that beam of light, the way to explain, in his words, our history to our children. Douglass spoke one of the most powerful moments when he's first made it out of slavery, the prison house of bondage. He described it, "As I stand now in prosperity and happiness, I would I could go on, but I cannot. As I think of my dear children, the grim horrors of slavery rise before me to pierce my heart and chill my blood. A slave mother has many children, but no family. Frederick Jr., we worked for the emancipation of the cause of our father." The question of the fact of the extent to which slavery denied and dehumanized was for Douglass a way of understanding possibilities of life in the face of death. He understood art as a way out of being, as he described it, a brand new fact. It's no surprise to all of us to know that Douglass repeatedly said, "I have been bought and sold on the abolitionist podium more than I was ever bought and sold on the auction blocks of the US South." As you look at this photograph, you can hear his words as he says, "This photograph strikes me as a faithful representation of the man. Upon public grounds, I thank the photographer for giving the country this admirable picture of our first colored American senator. Whatever may be the prejudices of those who look upon it, they will be compelled to admit that the Mississippi senator is a man, and one who is a man among men. We colored men so often see ourselves described and painted as monkeys, that we think it a piece of good fortune to find an exception to this general rule." Douglass's understanding of art and photography was nothing less than the belief that life was at stake. He understood that we are imprisoned, his words, in facts, as fixed facts in books that deny, dehumanize, and erase us. But in photography and art, we can see and feel the imagination. Douglass was at war, and you all will remember, so I have no need and I have no political reason to show you, the dehumanizing images from slavery. In your mind, you can see and understand the history of an abolitionist movement that was predicated on bodies of evidence. Not bodies as souls, bodies as facts. As Douglass described it, not bodies as living, breathing humanity, but bodies as iron arguments of proof. Douglass was told when he stood on the abolitionist podium, "Do not use too much refined speech. 'Tis best you don't seem too learned." To which Douglass said, "I will speak the word to be spoken by me." I did not feel just like narrating wrongs. I felt like denouncing them. Douglass was insistent repeatedly, you'll know the story, of who he is and how he should be greeted as Mr. Editor, if you please. Douglass understood and Douglass lived by the belief, two convictions that he held, that language has no power and the image is mute. Language has no power and image is mute. So as you look at the photographs of Douglass, and as you know, he was the most photographed American, black or white, in US history, you see Douglass speaking to you, as he described it, not as an iron argument, but as the inner via the outer man. Douglass violates, rejects, and refuses the conventions of white plantation civility. He directly confronts his black and white photographers, and he directly looks down on you as an audience as he rejects the abolitionist directive. Douglass, as were so many, was forced to strip on the abolitionist podium to show his scars. Later, he writes of it with traumatized language. "I myself was called upon to exhibit my back. With many misgiving notions, I obeyed the summons. Only for a tiny window," he soon refuses that mandate. "I must speak the word to be spoken by me, and I must speak of slavery in the ways to be spoken of by me." In these photographs, you see Douglass communicating to you the burden he had and that haunted him through his whole life. In the 7,000 items that survived that Douglass wrote, and we find more every day, we find more photographs every day, Douglass held on to the belief that those who lived and died in slavery that he had left behind were the spirits that walked beside him. He described it as the bleeding family I can never see again. Douglass understood that their suffering and their struggle was never to be forgotten. He described it as the grim horror, as I said a moment before, that pierces my heart and chills my blood. As Douglass was forced to parade his story by white abolitionists, who to him were white racist apologists, that, as he described it, put me under overseership on the abolitionist stand, he was persistently working against a dominant iconographic trend. I don't need to tell you that the ways in which white abolitionists worked was by exhibiting their box of tricks, Douglass's word, their elements of torture, their elements of shackles. And as Sojourner Truth would say, "Where is your blood on that shackle? Where is the hair? Tell me the stories that are missing." She repeatedly said, "I come from another country, the country of the slave. Harriet Tubman, I've seen the real thing." So for Douglass and others, this question of bearing witness is one that lives on. And you see it very powerfully in Douglass's photography. Douglass is representing Frederick Douglass, the mythological icon, the powerful activist who becomes a symbol of freedom. But he is also speaking to the suffering and the struggle and the memory of Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey. And Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey lives on throughout his life. Frederick Douglass, as we know, was not only a household name, he was a household image. And he was particularly incensed against the representation and the disfigured representation of his face and body. I've made the decision to include none of those today, but those of you who've seen them will know what I'm talking about. The ways in which he was subjected to, as he described it, a horrifying caricature of my face. Douglas was incensed at the ways in which blackness was represented in a white racist imaginary. And these are his words. "Negroes can never have impartial portraits at the hands of white artists. It seems to us next to impossible for white men to take likenesses of black men without most grossly exaggerating their distinctive features. The reason is obvious. Artists, like all other white persons, have adopted a theory respecting the distinctive features of Negro physiognomy. We have heard many white persons say that Negroes all look alike. They associate with the Negro face, high cheekbones, distended nostrils, depressed noses, thick lips, and retreating foreheads. If I were to paint them, I have words I would use." This theme, impressed strongly on the mind of an artist, exercises a powerful influence over his pencil, and very naturally leads him to distort and exaggerate those peculiarities, even when they scarcely exist in the original. "Everyone to his taste, but do not trample on human rights." Douglas had a conviction throughout his life of the ways in which white scientific racism, and this is his particular visualizing black to forms of European Enlightenment racist ideology, he had a conviction to understanding the ways in which black bodies and lives were bought and sold in the official archive. What you're looking at here is a document he carried with him throughout his life. It's his bill of sale. Douglas described this document as a document that was a chattel record. We live and die in chattel records, not in historical annals. Look not for us in historical memory. Spending a lifetime memorializing heroism, Margaret Garner, Toussaint Louverture, Sengbe Pei, Douglas was exercised about the fact that black lives were invisibilized in the archive. Those iconic Toussaint, Sengbe Pei, Nathaniel Turner were treated with barbarous indifference, disfigurement, and torture. Those who lived and died, who made it not out of slavery, were nameless, faceless, and bodiless. He called this a chattel record, and he understood the only way to move from being a chattel record was to become an author, an artist, in charge of that language that has no power and that image that is mute. Douglas understood a work of art as a way of understanding sublime inner life, no longer shackles, objects, bodies of proof, but living, breathing humanity. Douglas believed in authorship. He persistently, consistently, throughout his life, and it is all through his archive, said, "I want literature, not ledgers. I want art in the face of death." Douglas is one of his most powerful words that he uses, and I'm writing this literary biography, and it's not easy. Mr. Douglas does not make it easy. He's written thousands, and his power of his use of language and narrative defies any kind of interpretation. I'll never get to a tiny fragment of an understanding. He describes that we become, under the overseer's whip, and these are his words, living parchments. No longer chattel records, but living parchments on which we can tell our stories and our lives. Living parchments. Then we become a work of art. In the 1840s, on the abolitionist podium, and understanding anti-slavery rhetoric and the ideology and how it operated, Douglas was especially aware of the ways in which his own photography was represented. You see here a clip from a newspaper because it gives you a sense of what Douglas was combating. At the same time that Douglas is looking at you and visualizing the face of the fugitive slave, as he described it, he is represented alongside bodies of proof of white victimization and martyrdom. Douglas understood that black lives didn't matter in abolitionist ideology, or they only mattered insofar as they served white abolitionist myths of activism. And we all know that myth. White abolitionists believed that you moved from slavery to freedom, the teleology of uplift. Born into slavery, the Josiah Wedgwood medallion, am I not a man and a brother? Am I not a woman and a sister? And you move into liberty and freedom in a journey of no return. Douglas, as an individual who suffered, and I cannot overemphasize how much he suffered from psychological torture, from a sense of suicidal beliefs, every springtime, especially times of selling, Douglas as an individual understood that the life of slavery bled on into a life of freedom. And he also understood that that life of freedom was a freedom that was in name only. One of the images that he especially hated, and the reason I include it here is because he talks extensively about it, is this image. He describes, this book is one to prove what exactly? That I and us are simply, the present reviewer, myself, a member of the human race. The superior portraits are of the commonest sort. That of Frederick Douglass, we shall leave you to understand, begging only to remark that it is very much more kindly and an amiable expression than the face of the fugitive slave. We all know Douglass's belief and his insistence and his challenge to white northern abolitionists when he tells them to go and hear, his words, the wild, incoherent songs of slaves and then tell me of contentment in slavery. What you see with Douglass, too, is his belief in and his conviction to the sorrow images of slavery, the face of the fugitive slave. In dominant representations, in artistic imagery, he's constantly presented like this, in processes of self-formation, partially there, partially not there. Repeated photographs and paintings, I'm sharing with you unknown, recently discovered paintings, we don't know the provenance or date, in which he's vilified, dehumanized, and misrepresented. The image here is one that especially incensed him. People take occasion to speak of me as a fine young Negro. That is a way of describing a slave for sale. It's true that I was once advertised in slavery in a very respectable newspaper under a little figure bent over and apparently in a hurry to the north with my bundle on my back. Especially incensed, especially agitated, Douglass writes a powerful editorial in the North Star. The North Star, a newspaper that is edited by Rosetta, typeset by Lewis Henry, advertised by Frederick Jr., and sold by Charles Raymond, and physically funded by Anna Murray. Think of the moral sentiment of the most influential part of the community, stringing together, in company with horses, sheep, and swine, the figures of 40 human beings, to be disposed of in the same markets with the former. To each of these advertisements of slaves on the run is prefixed the figure of a human being as if in the act of running. We have no such figures nor prints in our office to enable you to follow copy. The reader must supply them for themselves. Douglass refused to buy the iconic woodcuts of enslaved people running to freedom on the grounds that they dehumanized and violated a human right. Everyone to his taste, as long as they do not violate human rights. This is a powerful drawing that was done in the 1840s, and it was done at the moment that Douglass is in the UK. And it has a sarcastic and amusing story that Douglass treasured till he died. What you're looking at is the song sheet of a song that was composed by T. Powys Griffiths, the brother of Julia, and it's from a bust that is missing. Now, Douglas loved to tell this anecdote. It's based on a bust that was made by a very famous British sculptor, William Beneys, and it was exhibited in the Royal Exchange in London. Sadly, that was bombed in World War II, and we've no records, but I'm not going to give up. I should, but I'm not going to give up. And it's based on a statue. Now, Douglas, who was very choosy as to what he would allow Frederick May Holland to put in the biography he publishes just before Douglas dies, Douglas is at his shoulder, proofreading, editing, checking, and deleted. And Douglas allows this story and this anecdote to go in. He talks about a white US senator coming from the South on the grand tour of Britain and meeting an English art collector. And the English art collector says to him, "I have a powerful, beautiful collection of art. You must come and see it. Especially, you must see my beautiful sculpture of your countryman, Douglas." And as you are all aware in this room, the US senator says, "I'm so happy to see my compatriot, Mr. Douglas, represented." But of course, to his disappointment, and the only words Douglas allows to go in the biography, the statue was in black marble. This is strong language. For the sake of my people, I would to God it were vehemently strong. But my words are only as to the shadow, as to the substance. They fail, however bitter my experience. There is no language to describe what I went through. But a picture is a power, and the ability to give form and expression to facts and to appeal to experience is a way of light out of death. Douglas's commitment to representing and reimagining the face of the fugitive slave, as he described it, was a way of bearing witness to those who lived and died in slavery. Sorrow images and sorrow songs. As you look across his archive, you see an array of beautiful and powerful imagery. There is a vast morass of racist imagery that I'm not sharing, and Douglas was very exercised about its power and its endurance. His commitment to the image, despite his understanding that it was mute, one of the most powerful figures in his life, he never was able to keep any memento of her likeness. Harriet Bailey, his mother, was one that pained him for his entire existence, to the extent he recreated an imaginary figure in memorializing her face and her memory. He describes it as her silhouette, "I can't see." One of the very few images Douglas keeps and protects and looks after is this one. And we have very little information about it, except that we know it was made from an engraving of an original daguerreotype that is now lost, as is often the way. And Douglas kept it and treasured it so much, it was on and among his personal possessions when he died. We don't know the provenance, and one of the difficulties with the vast majority of his photographs, with which we know for certain Augustus Washington and various other important black daguerreotypists and artists, Robert Douglas among them, were repeatedly taking his photograph, but we are still unable to prove. This image speaks very powerfully to the black artist Patrick Reason's beautiful aesthetic. As we know, Douglas was close friends and a great advocate and supporter of Reason, and you see in this beautiful image here the intricacy that Douglas loved. He described it as "the scars on my skin beautifully represented." Among the very few surviving works by Patrick Reason is this one that's the frontispiece to Henry Bibb. At the bottom, you see the figure running north. Those racist caricatures of black humanity Douglas despised and refused to reproduce in his newspaper. But above, one of the most beautiful portraits of Henry Bibb in existence. The meticulousness of the beauty of the line and the symmetry Douglas applauded. So for Douglas, this fight for representation, this fight for representation and recreation was one that existed throughout his lifetime. One of the powerful repeated stories Douglas tells on the abolitionist podium. He says in Sheffield, and I want to share it with you today. "The atrocities of slavery produced a dissatisfaction that constantly manifests itself in the look of the slave. I have been punished and beaten more for my looks than anything else. For looking dissatisfied because I felt dissatisfied, the feelings and wrongs that have been heaped upon me as shown in my face." As you look here and see this powerful photograph that Douglas commissions for the start of My Bondage and My Freedom, you see Douglas embodying that form of resistance. Typically, Douglas refused to allow his hands to be seen in his photographs. But here you see him embodying those hand charms found in archaeological digs in the 18th century, the black power fists of radicalism. Later, and increasingly, you see that exemplified in his photography. At this point, and in this text, and as I've spoken of a moment before, he describes his continued fight for freedom, in freedom. "I was generally introduced as a chattel, a thing, amazing because it could speak, a brand new fact, the only one out." For Douglas, facts were a problem. Facts by whites were a problem. Facts by whites were a consistent, lifelong war. "I will not be represented as a fixed fact, a piece of public property. Instead, I will be a work of art." Writing extensively on the philosophy of art, as Douglas does, he has a belief in art as liberation. One of the most powerful phrases he says repeatedly is, "Pictures, images, and all other symbolical representations derive their power because they speak to the imagination." They speak to the imagination. In all of the images he commissions, he creates works in which he invites you as audience members to imagine what is missing. Despite being told the abolitionist directive of a white notion of authenticity of black life, that he must tell all the facts, Douglas often says, "I cannot commit to paper the feelings with which I represented it." Language has no power, his repeated refrain. Similarly, in using images throughout his life, he speaks to their failure, to their lack of power to memorialize the missing, the dead, and the unknown. You find Douglas's life memorialized in scrapbooks in which his name is abbreviated with a horror he despised. "I am never Fred, I am Frederick." In fact, to one distractor, he said, "Call me Frederick and meet me, and I will treat you as I treated Covey." That's for you, Walter. Douglas's images and his self-representations speak to the symbolic in the face of the factual. In 200 years of black radical activism, fighting a war for freedom and out of slavery, fighting another war for freedom on the abolitionist circuit, was one that continued to pain Douglas and was one that continued to inspire him. The European face is drawn in harmony with the highest ideas of beauty, dignity, and intellect, features regular and brow always after the Websterian mold. If the very best type of the European is always presented, I insist that justice be done and the very best type of the Negro be represented. Douglas's conviction and his power and his dedication to imagery was one of freedom out of slavery. One of the most powerful images that circulated, and again, I made a decision not to include it here today, is a caricature of Douglas that was created by no one other than Winslow Homer. At the moment in the Tremont Temple, as you'll know, in Boston, when a racist mob attacks Douglas and he has to escape with his life, what's recorded in Homer's vision is the grotesque caricature, the disfigured, dehumanized, shocking caricature of my face. But let me tell you the words that Douglas said of that moment. He says he's attacked by one white pro-slavery persecutor in the audience, and Douglas tells him this before he's removed from the room. If I was a slave driver and had hold of you for 5 minutes in Maryland, I would let more daylight through your skin than there's ever been before. That never made it into the newspaper reports. Douglas took people to court over his image. And just before he died, he was consistently in battle with one publishing company in particular. And again, I'm making the decision not to show you the images. So, as he says, you'll have to supply them for yourself. I beg to remind you that in the contract made with me, you said nothing about illustrations. This contract that I signed does not permit you to load the book with all manner of coarse and shocking woodcuts. You have gone outside the contract and have marred and spoiled my book entirely. I have no pleasure in it and shall not while the engravings remain. I think I have grounds for appealing to the law under contract and getting an injunction against your publishing the book in its present shape. He writes that in May 1881. In January 1882, very poignantly, he writes, I've given up all opposition. I submit to the caricature of my own face. But there is hope in the face of despair. Douglas writes this knowing that a week before, and I only found this out 3 weeks ago, he had written to John Lobb, the British publisher, to illegally give him the rights to the narrative on the provision he removed all grotesque and shocking woodcuts. Douglas made it impossible for the publisher in the US to make any money at all by undercutting him and having it sell in its thousands in Britain. There's more than one way to win a war. Now, I want to share with you one image before I end, and you've been all so kind in listening to me, an image that he loved. Now, this was a sculpture made, the bust by Johnson Mundy, who, let me tell you, was no radical freedom fighter for justice. I could show you some images that would shrivel up your heart and chill your blood, as Douglas would say, but here he got it right. And he got it right because a certain person comes repeatedly and gives him advice. I wonder who that might be. Mr. Douglas says, I will let you create a sculpture of me, but I will come and spend time with you. I can't spend time with you now because I cannot stand before an artist because my mouth is in terrible repair. One of the very little known facts of Douglas's life is the terrible suffering he had from dental problems as born of the struggles of slavery. As he says, slavery is no educator in health. Slavery is a place in which bodies are deformed and destroyed. When he gets his health, he repeatedly goes and builds a friendship with Mundy and educates Mundy on black human rights. So Mundy, who's an apologist for slavery, Mundy, who creates, Google him, horrifying images of enslaved and free people, learns through Douglas to sculpt and paint another way. This is the only sculpture Douglas spoke about as being one that breathes and lives. So if we remember Douglas's hatred of images that made him a fixed fact, a public property, this was an image that he saw as one that breathed and lived and spoke to the inner via the outer man. When it's unveiled in 1879, he writes a private letter that I found a year ago, and he talks about it. This powerful sculpture has a traumatizing effect on Douglas when he sees it. And it takes him a long time to reconcile himself to it. Douglas, throughout his life, is very powerfully, very psychologically upset about the question of the life between the public and the private self. This was a boundary and a line that consistently caused him all forms of torture, torment, and suffering. Now, what he says about this sculpture speaks to that. Incidents of this character, the unveiling of a statue to me in the University of Rochester, does much in my life to amaze me. But it is not, however, the heights to which I have risen, but the depths from which I have come that most amaze me. This is 1879. It seems only a little while ago I was a child, that I might have been seen fighting the dog, Old Nep, my master's dog, for a small piece of the crumbs that fell from the kitchen table, when I slept in the hearth, covering my head in a corn bag and sleeping in the warm ashes. Only a little while ago was I dragged to prison to be sold to the highest bidder, exposed as a slave, like a beast of burden. Later, put out to live no life with Covey, beaten and almost broken in spirit. Yet here I am, alive. Douglas spends a lifetime curating and creating and engaging with images that are mute and images that have no power. He spends a lifetime speaking to struggle, survival, and suffering. And I want to share with you the will of Helen Pitts Douglas. We all know that Frederick Douglass, on seeing this monument, was in absolute outrage. A more manly stance would have been fitting. So he gives a directive at his death that Helen Pitts follows. As you look to a few lines down, there shall be established in Cedar Hill a monument to the memory of Frederick Douglass, which monument shall be designed and executed by an artist or artists of highest ability. Said monument to contain no kneeling slave or slaves, and no chain or chains broken or otherwise, or any symbol of servitude or suffering. But said monument shall express the idea of attainment, either attained or possible, and shall be surrounded by statues of the bronze of Mr. Douglas, and contain a bronze medallion of him. No chains or chains, kneeling or otherwise. At the point of his death, he also instructs Helen Pitts Douglas to have a death mask taken. And it's with great power I show you this image to you of Douglas at peace and at rest. She was exercised to ensure that in death, as in life, Douglas was recorded with fidelity to his physiognomy. Douglas loved Daguerrean technology because it had an accuracy of line. It was able to do justice to every contour of his skin, every scar on his body. Similarly, in the photograph she commissions just as he's passed, she wants to honor that legacy as Douglas had instructed her to leave us with his physiognomy and not the grotesque caricature of my face. Life is a picture of progress. It may be called the divine essence of the universe. Order, strength, and beauty are its development. But to be seen and heard best, we must stop our ears and shut our eyes and begin to imagine. Life is agitation, and agitation is life. Progress is life. To stand still is stagnation, and stagnation is death. Pictures are a progress. I wanted to share you this with you because this is so beautiful. This is Willie Penn writing to Mr. Douglas on December 12, 1894. As we all know, Mr. Douglas has only 2 months to live by this point. And he writes to Douglas and he tells him he's sending him a crayon portrait that he's made, one that I've drawn of yourself. Douglas treasured this crayon portrait. Unfortunately, it no longer survives, but it speaks to the ways in which photographs and portraits and representations memorialize a view of Frederick Douglass that sustains the life of Frederick Bailey and the many lives of Douglass as author, editor, and intellectual. As Rashid Johnson today has engaged with Douglass's iconicity in remaking himself according to the portrait of Frederick Douglass, he also honours those whose lives we do not know, homeless women, men and children living on the streets of Chicago. This man refused to give his name, and this man refused to allow us to see his face. As Douglass repeatedly refused to show the scars on his back, as Douglass repeatedly refused to parade the inner life of Harriet, of his brother and sisters, so too Rashid Johnson engages with that memory. For Frederick Douglass, just before he died, living with his elder brother, Perry, he talks about, "I should write his narrative, but I cannot. I cannot revisit what I went through. Let the dead bury the dead. I will not resurrect the ghostly memory of slavery from its grave." So for Frederick Douglass, living with the scars of slavery, as his sons lived with the wounds of war, the question then and the question now is always, what happens if I survive? Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.